Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
All right, everyone, welcome back to the Law of Code podcast. I'm really excited to share this episode with you today. This is part one of a two-part series with Amanda Tuminelli, the Chief Legal Officer at the DeFi Education Fund, and Jake Travinsky, who is on the board there. I'll introduce them fully in a second, but part one, we'll talk about the Roman Storm case involving Tornado Cash, and part two, we'll cover the pre-enforcement lawsuit against the SEC that the DEF, or the DeFi Education Fund, has recently filed. Let's start with part one, though. So the Roman Storm, actually, before we get into part one, Amanda Tuminelli is the DeFi Education Fund's Chief Legal Officer, where she leads the organization's impact litigation and policy efforts. Jake Travinsky recently joined Variant as Chief Legal Officer, where he leads the firm's legal team and works closely with portfolio founders to overcome regulatory hurdles that obviously holds them back. He's also a board member for the DeFi Education Fund. So today, the DEF submitted an amicus brief in the Roman Storm matter, which involves Tornado Cash. Let's just quickly start with the facts of that case and how we got here, perhaps even a refresher on how Tornado Cash works.
So the Department of Justice indicted Roman Storm and Roman Semenov, alleging that they were two of three founders of the Tornado Cash protocol. They filed their indictment in the Southern District of New York, and they alleged three different conspiracies against the Romans. They say that they conspired to launder money, they conspired to run an unlicensed money transmitter business, and they conspired to violate IEPA, which is the general sanctions statute. So, and more specifically, North Korean sanctions. So they filed that indictment and take this very wide view that basically the Romans' decision to create the protocol and publish it and then also create a user interface and eventually the beginning of the DAO all together constitutes what the government is calling the Tornado Cash service. So one thing we point out is this is not a great packaging of different component parts, and they should not be packaged in this way, but that is how the indictment talks about it. They put all these separate things together, and they say that through running that service, the Romans have engaged in this conspiracy conduct. So we chose to focus in our brief on two of the three conspiracies. We chose to focus on the conspiracy to launder money and the conspiracy to violate sanctions. We have great friends who are also filing other amicus briefs that will focus on the other conspiracy in count two, which is the money transmitter business, which is also very important. But since we had limited pages, we decided to divide and conquer. I'll let Jake talk about where we're coming from and the theory behind money laundering. But I think overall, the way that the DOJ has chosen to handle the creation of software in broad strokes is novel and unprecedented. They are basically saying that the creation of software on day one creates liability for software developers on day 1000 or 2000 when other third-party people use that software to commit various crimes. And that is just not the way that the law is supposed to work on any of the charges that they've included in the indictment, and it has really dangerous repercussions if it is validated by the court.
And just before we jump to you, Jake, Amanda, the one thing I wanted to touch on quickly there is this idea that the Romans were involved in Tornado Cash. And there are two, I think it's two facts that you guys mentioned that the government alleges or uses to say, okay, they were still involved in committing this conspiracy with regard to website hosting, paying fees. Could you expand what those are?
So according to the indictment, the fact that the Romans were still paying to host the user interface for years, the fact that they received TORN tokens and participated in any way in the DAO, the fact that the smart contracts just continue to exist, it seems like, all underlies the government's theory here. To be quite honest, the indictment is not very good at parsing exactly what the government thinks the facts are that connect the Romans to the protocol years after it was created. They really hang their hats on the user interface and the DAO and governance of the DAO, in my opinion. I'm sure Jake will have more to say about that too. But I think that this is in many ways the most dangerous case to crypto that no one is talking about, because the chilling effect here of just creating a protocol and releasing it to the world and having governance that is diverse and, you know, mostly decentralized. We have to rely on the facts that are asserted in the indictment. So we can't inject our own facts into the case at this point. So we have to really rely on what the government has said about the technology. But the government even does differentiate the protocol from the DAO, from the Relayer registry, from the user interface. And even with those differentiations, they kind of miss the point that you can't tie the software developer who started this whole thing to the way it all ends up without actually proving that, without actually proving some evidence as to how they could have controlled everything the government claims they controlled.
Jake, did you want to add to the background there?
Yeah, I think maybe before we get into that, it's worth saying a few more words about what Tornado Cash actually does and why it matters as a technology to begin with. And Tornado Cash is a privacy-preserving protocol built on top of Ethereum. And I'll spare everyone the detailed technical explanation about how it works. But in general, what Tornado Cash allowed users to do is to sever the tie between transactions from one wallet to another. And this is very important in the context of a public blockchain. Now, obviously, we love public blockchains. They give us many benefits for many reasons. They're trustless, they're permissionless, they're resilient, they're secure, but they are also totally transparent. And that's a good thing in some cases, but a very bad thing when it comes to privacy. And privacy matters a whole lot. You know, we've all recognized here in the United States and also elsewhere around the world that privacy is a fundamental human right, that it is essential to human dignity that we get to decide what sensitive information about our own lives we share with other people and when we want to share it. And financial transactions get straight to the heart of the most sensitive activities that we conduct in our lifetimes, right? Which political causes we decide to support, where we worship, what types of products we decide to buy, who we decide to spend our time with. All of this is revealed by our financial transactions. And you can imagine in a world where the vast majority of our financial transactions take place on chain, it is very important that we are able to preserve our privacy in that environment so that a single transaction with, for example, an employer who makes a payment of salary on chain doesn't mean that every other transaction we ever make in our lives is suddenly accessible to every other person in the world. So very important for us to have privacy-preserving technology like Tornado Cash. And essentially what Tornado Cash allowed users to do is to deposit assets into an immutable smart contract protocol and then withdraw those assets to another wallet using zero-knowledge proofs so that there was no way for a third party to say which withdrawal matches up with which deposit. And that allows people to use this tool to preserve their privacy for whatever means they want, whether that is lawful or whether it is unlawful. And we do know that there was some unlawful use of the Tornado Cash protocol, such as by sanctioned parties like the Lazarus Group in North Korea and potentially others. But there was also a vast amount of lawful use of Tornado Cash by people who simply did not want all of their transactions to be public. So we see this case brought by the Department of Justice framing Tornado Cash essentially as a criminal money laundering service, which is wrong in two really important ways. The first is it could be used for literally any purpose whatsoever. And again, the vast majority of use of Tornado Cash was not unlawful. It's just ordinary people trying to preserve their privacy. And secondly, Tornado Cash was not a service when you consider how the technology actually worked. And that's why it's so important, as Amanda explained, to identify the specific pieces of this ecosystem and then understand how the defendants in this case, the software developers who built this tool, are actually related to that that tool. And the core of the tool was this set of immutable smart contracts that could not be changed and could not be affected by anyone. So when the government frames them as being offered as a service, it's just a fundamental misunderstanding of how this technology works. So I think that's important background for us before we get into more of the legal analysis here.
Yeah, thank you. And I agree. The facts of the blockchain really changed the game just in terms of words like control and possession and property interest. And we'll touch on that because I think that plays a big factor in the brief that you filed. But let's just step back for a second and take this 10,000 foot view. So we've spoken a bit about financial privacy. We've spoken about Tornado Cash. Why is it important that the DEF intervene in matters like this? What's the overarching reason to be involved in a case like this? And Jake, I'll turn this to you as a board member.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I'll give you my perspective on the purpose of the DeFi Education Fund, which is to advance the adoption of decentralized technology by supporting all of the different participants who interact with or build that technology, whether that's users or developers of the technology. And I think it's really important for DEF to show up in a case like this to advocate not specifically for these defendants, but for other software developers who want to build useful tools like privacy preserving technologies without fear that the next thing that happens is the FBI knocks down their door and puts them in handcuffs simply because they decided to develop open source software. And really, open source software is at the heart not only of the crypto industry, but also at the heart of this case. We're talking about software developers who are expressing their creativity in the form of code, right? They are speaking in the form of code, and they are releasing those tools to be used by anyone in the world, just like any other neutral tool that can be used for good or for evil. And we need to protect their ability to do that without saying you are going to be held responsible for totally unforeseeable misuse of the technology that you have developed. We don't take that view with respect to any other technology that I can think of in the world, right? Whether that's, you know, ordinary tools like cell phones or automobiles or, you know, folks who build buildings, right? The construction worker who builds a building is not liable for how some other person decides to use the building in the future. The same with automobile manufacturers, the same with every other type of producer, inventor of technology. And it seems here that the Department of Justice is saying they're going to apply a different standard to crypto. And the reason for that, which we can talk about a little bit more, I think is political and policy related, much more so than it is grounded in the law. And that's where I think DEF can do its best work, is to show up and explain why policy requires us to give the benefit of the doubt and to protect software developers, and also to explain how the government is trying to twist the law in a way that achieves its goal, even though the law doesn't actually support that theory that the government is advancing. And that's a quintessential example of what's happening here in the Tornado Cash case.
And in the brief, it's written that the indictment sets forth three theories of criminal liability for software developers that are historically unprecedented and legally unsupported. I want to just talk about those three theories before we get into the more nuanced discussions of arguments. So the first is that developers are liable for violating the International Emergency Economic Powers Act when they publish open source software that is later used by a sanctioned entity. Without discussing the merits at this point yet, Amanda, could you share what the other two theories were there? And just remind listeners, I know you mentioned it earlier.
Oh, so other than AIPA, the other two allegations in the indictment are that the founders of Tornado Cash conspired to run an unlicensed money transmitter business. And the other count is that they conspired to launder money. So they have different time periods alleged, but they all generally refer to the time after Tornado Cash became live.
And it being mentioned that these are historically unprecedented and legally unsupported, those are pretty strong words to use. And let's just briefly touch on AIPA and the basis that argument comes from, that there has never been, AIPA has never been used to penalize a builder for creating technology that with no willful involvement from the creator was later used by a sanctioned entity. And I thought this argument was really strong. So I'd love to just hear you expand on how the DEF pushes back there.
Yeah, happy to. And we picked strong language, because that is what we were seeing in the, or what we were not seeing in cases. So we have reviewed nearly 100 cases. It's probably more than 100 cases at this point, but we've picked out the cases where the government brought IEPA charges against an individual defendant. They can also bring the same charges against like a company or even an action that's against actually the funds themselves or property itself. But we picked individual defendants where the government accused them of violating IEPA, attempting to, or conspiring to. And I was actually just doing this right before we started talking today, and I will continue to be doing this until the moment we file. But it is very clear across all of these cases, and I'm not just talking about this in the Second Circuit, so not even only where this indictment is filed, but we did like a countrywide search. In all of these cases, there are allegations that the defendant specifically conspired or knowingly, directly, and actively engaged with a sanctioned entity. So the standard for a criminal IEPA violation is that the conduct must be willful. The defendant has to willfully conspire or send or export goods to a controlled entity or a blocked entity. And in all of those cases, that's there. There is an allegation that the defendant knew that they had a counterparty. So maybe they were sending funds to Iran or they were sending goods to Iran, but they certainly knew that their counterparty on the other side of the transaction was a sanctioned entity or a person associated with a sanctioned entity. There aren't even, and we did look specifically for cases that dealt with software or technology. But in all of the cases, there is at least a tie, a direct and knowing engagement with a sanctioned entity. We have not found a single case where a person just released a tool or a technology of some kind into the world, a sanctioned entity later used it, and then that person is held responsible for violating IEPA. It's just not how it ends up being pled. And I think that's because, one, technology, of course, is changing the game, and technology is now a huge part of our world in a way that it wasn't even like 20 years ago. But two, IEPA is not meant to be used this way. It is not meant to be used to criminalize the creation of something without that active and knowing engagement in the sanctioned entity. That's why the standard is willful. That means that you have to know that you're engaging in some kind of illegal conduct. And here, the government doesn't allege that. They do not, and nowhere in the indictment did they say the Romans contacted North Korea or like had any engagement whatsoever, or even knowingly ran a part of the user interface such that North Korea could use it, right? There isn't even this like manifestation of an intention to engage with North Korea anywhere in the indictment. And I think that dooms the IEPA claim, at least according to all of the cases that I have seen so far.
When you have 100+ cases, you can start to use terminology like historically unprecedented and legally unsupported. So I want to just quickly shift gears and talk about the government's perspective. Amanda, you alluded to the idea of a chilling effect. Jake mentioned, you know, the government's a policy move, and it's not necessarily, as you just mentioned, grounded in precedent. We hear a lot of the sentiment of a growing divide between supporters of this technology and those who are against it. Why is this happening? I'm asking you to speculate, but I'm just curious, like, why do you see this, or what could potential reasons be for the government going against or going after a technology?
Right. Well, at its core, crypto is a challenge to the authority of the nation state, and there's no way around that. And we see that more in the national security space and the law enforcement space than we do anywhere else. So let me give you my best speculation about the perspective of policymakers who would support an action like this. I think their view is, and this is very understandable, there is some amount of illicit activity that happens on public blockchains. And Tornado Cash itself was, as I mentioned, used in part to launder funds that were stolen by the Lazarus Group, which is the cyber hacking group of the state of North Korea, in order to fund North Korea's missile program. And that's not any kind of joking matter, right? This is a very serious thing that, as a geopolitical matter, the United States should care about and should try to address. There's nobody in this industry or in this country who wants to see this technology abused by brutal dictators like Kim Jong-un, who commit human rights abuses to build a nuclear missile program that gives them a geopolitical advantage. So at the outset, it's easy to understand why the government would want to do something about a tool that is being used, at least in part, by our foreign adversaries. But the problem is, the government also looks at this technology and says, we are deeply uncomfortable with the concept of a financial system that we cannot surveil and cannot control. And indeed, the way that law enforcement has been done for roughly the last 50 years since the Bank Secrecy Act was first implemented is that most law enforcement happens by tracing the money, by surveilling and stopping transactions that involve illicit activity. And again, to a degree, that's a good thing. We don't want money laundering to occur. We want to deny criminals the benefit of ill-gotten gains to discourage them from committing more crime. But what this means is the government looks at decentralized technology and simply says, we do not like this thing. And, you know, for a while, it was easy for us to say the government just didn't understand what a public blockchain was, what the benefits of decentralization are. And I think we're frankly past that point with a large group in the government who now will say we totally understand what it means to have a trust minimized, permissionless, censorship resistant global financial system. And we don't think that it should exist. We would prefer to have centralization in all cases. The problem is that they don't have the legal authority to actually go after that type of technology. And so that's why we see them trying to expand their own jurisdiction to go after crypto in a case like this.
Two terms that I really wanted to discuss with you both are mentioned in the brief as being very important. And that is, the first is property interest, and the second is possession or control. And blockchains really changed the discussion around money laundering, particularly in relation to those items where historically there is this intermediary who does take possession of or control of a property interest, and it acts as that intermediary to facilitate the transactions. Whereas here, we have almost something that can be analogized to a highway that offers, you know, money to come in and go out in a separate way without intervention of either the creator or the developer of this tool, or let's say the builder of the highway. So why are terms like property interest and possession or control so important to the case that the DEF sets forward here?
So they're important because they're incorporated into IEPA and the North Korean sanctions regime. So the government's burden in a case like this one is to prove that a U.S. person has possession or control over the sanctioned entity's interest in property or property interest of some kind, and that they've taken some action with it. And if you look at just the very basic definitions of possession or control and property interest, it becomes very clear that it just doesn't apply to a smart contract protocol vis-a-vis the creator of that protocol. So to say that a little bit better, there's no technologically accurate way to say that a smart contract developer has possession or control over user funds when user funds are passing through a smart contract protocol. And I know there's also this like fallacy out there that the smart contracts themselves sometimes have, like people say they somehow have possession or control, which is just makes absolutely no sense. It's, you know, they're like inanimate software. But in this case, the key point here is that the government has no valid way to say that the Romans had possession or control over user property of any kind, let alone North Korean property, as it was passed through the Tornado Cash protocol. So if you look at the cases and the way they've just evolved over time, there is usually an allegation that funds were sent somewhere. Like I have funds in my possession and I physically send them somewhere, whether that's by wire or by mail or a hawala system. And in this case, there just isn't that. And we use this analogy in our brief that I really like, which is people, when you say like you're sending funds on the blockchain, people do envision that, right? They think of like funds going somewhere, but that's not really what happens. Instead, it's more like I have agreed to allow a safe manufacturer to build a safe around my assets, and I will only ever know the combination. The safe manufacturer will never know the combination to the safe. But while the safe is in place, I can't move my funds, but neither can the safe manufacturer. They can't send them anywhere. They can't exclude me from them because I'm the only one that has the combination. My assets are just locked in place by this safe. And then when I choose to unlock my funds, I can put in the combination and then I have the ability to send them somewhere. But for that whole period of time that the safe is around my assets, the safe manufacturer can't do anything about it. And that's the analogy that we use here with a smart contract protocol system. A user may, quote unquote, lock their funds in the protocol, but that does not transfer the property interest in those funds to the smart contract developers. It does not give the smart contract developers the right to possess them or control them or exclude the user from their funds. And I think that concept is missing, like it's not even considered in the indictment. There's also a really great paper by Cravath lawyers, including Dan Barabender, that talks about sufficient and necessary control. And I would just flag for your listeners that that is a paper that goes in depth on the tech, does a really great job of explaining why smart contract developers don't have the requisite level of control to say that they control user funds in the Tornado Cash protocol.
And we'll link that paper in the show notes for anyone who's interested in checking it out. The last question for you regarding this case is, what's next? So the brief's filed today, and so the podcast is coming out on Friday, April 5th. What happens now? What's the timeline here? What are you expecting over the next couple months?
So there isn't a deadline by which the judge has to rule other than trial is set for the fall. So presumably the judge, who I will say is Judge Fela, the Coinbase judge, and who, you know, just recently released that opinion that we all hate so much, she will have to rule before trial or move the trial, I guess. So that sort of gives us a timeline of sometime in the next 6 months, there should be a ruling on this motion. I would also just note that Roman Storm's lawyers also moved to compel discovery and moved to suppress certain evidence. So it's the motion to dismiss the indictment is not the only pending motion. So there's actually three motions that need to be decided before the case gets to a trial ready place.
So we've got some time. Thank you. That's part one. Check back next week for part two with the DEFs, Amanda Tuminelli and Variance Jake Chervinsky. Thank you, guys. Yeah.